We want to say a word about the legacies of the Tokyo trial. In 1945, the United States brought the unfinished Tokyo trial to an end without ever having disclosed, in the words of the Dutch Justice Rowling, quote, one centrally given criminal order to kill for the sake of killing, unquote. And U.S. policy thereafter required that Japan be prepared as a Cold War ally and a peace process expedited to end the occupation. So commutation of sentence, parole, and clemency for the recently convicted war criminals followed, and a decade later, the last war criminal was set free. And then in 1959, the Yasukuni Shrine, which honored martyrs for the state and played a central role in Japan's wars of aggression, started enshrining soldiers who had been executed as B and C class war criminals. I think that from the occupation period until the late 1980s, early 90s, Japanese discussions of war crimes trials were essential to the politics of Japanese pacifist identity. Since then, the conservative parties of Japan have essentially argued that Imperial Japan fought the war in accordance with rules determined by international law, and Class A war criminals are not considered criminals. This is, of course, a total repudiation of the war crimes trials and their results. How this will play out eventually remains to be seen. To conclude this portion of my presentation, analyzing the Tokyo trial from the perspective of later history forces one to ask, if this international tribunal had been an example of democratic ideals, how would it have been conducted? What would have been its legacies? And would they have been different from the ones I described? Let's turn to the main event. The main event was the BC trials. The BC trials that the press ignored at the time. That was the main event. When you turn to the lesser, these so-called lesser trials of Japanese soldiers and civilians charged with murder, rape, torture, wanton destruction of property, kidnapping, similar questions of justice arise. B-level trials dealt with Japanese accused of having ordered, authorized, or failed to prevent conventional war crimes. C-level trials handled the actual perpetrators of those crimes. The BC trials were not of great interest to most journalists at the time, and they remain relatively unstudied, yet they were the principal means by which most Japanese war criminals were punished. For Americans, these trials pose vital moral and political problems because they reveal elements in a pattern of Japanese POW abuse that the Bush administration has replicated. Furthermore, like Nuremberg and Tokyo, these military commission trials helped the U.S. military to acquire power and authority over prisoners that, until 1945, it did not have. Nevertheless, one important achievement of the BC trials was to have set precedents for dealing with war crimes that carry over to the present. Now, the first of the BC trials was held in Manila. In late 45, MacArthur set up the first U.S. military commissions in Manila to try Generals Yamashita Tomoyuki and Homma Shigeharu. Yamashita had formally surrendered his 14th Area Army on September 3, 1945. Some weeks earlier, during the U.S. battle to recapture the island's rampaging Japanese sailors, under his overall command, had sacked Manila, had murdered and mistreated over 36,000 Filipino civilians and some American POWs. Yamashita was charged not with committing any specific criminal act, but with failing, quote, to control the operations of the members of his command. Honma's crime was to have commanded the Japanese forces that conquered the Philippines, bombed Manila after MacArthur declared it an open city, and committed atrocities on the death march out of Bataan. Both Yamashita and Homma were hurriedly convicted and hung. though not before their cases were reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court, which yielded to expediency and upheld the military commission's judgment, though with very strong and interesting dissents. The case against Yamashita was decided according to the strictest standard ever devised to hold a commander responsible for the actions of his subordinates. And Yamashita was found guilty for the mistreatment of 400 American prisoners of war who were billeted within walking distance of his headquarters. Because Yamashita was not judged for what he actually did, his case remains controversial. But here's the point. It clearly established the concept, the doctrine even, of command responsibility, which thereafter played an important role in other trials by military commissions. As a concept, command responsibility has been codified in the 1977 protocol to the Geneva Conventions. But when U.S. forces in Vietnam committed large-scale war atrocities, the Defense Department applied more lenient standards for American generals and commanders than were used to convict Yamashita and Homma. Yet Yamashita's refusal to take responsibility for the crimes of his subordinates was no different than the refusal of senior American commanders in Vietnam to acknowledge their responsibility for the crimes of subordinates. Now, subsequent military commission trials were also hastily established after MacArthur, after the Yamashita and Homma cases were heard and decided. The combined total of Japanese charge with BC-level offenses was approximately 5,700. Of this number, as many as 952 Japanese soldiers and civilians were actually convicted and executed for having committed conventional war crimes. This was more than double the number of Nazi war criminals executed in the Western zones of occupied Germany between 1946 and 1951. And approximately 3,000 Japanese received prison terms of varying lengths. But to me, the case law resulting from the BC trials is in many ways more interesting than Tokyo, which everybody writes about. I'd like to start bringing this talk to an end by saying that from any historical perspective, assertions of unique Japanese cruelty in the treatment of Allied prisoners do not hold up. When you look closely at the cases, the Japanese Army classified captives as regular or irregular POWs, and it kept the former in camps under Army Ministry jurisdiction. According to Japanese historian Utsumi Aiko, prisoners in such camps were subject to international law and their names were communicated via the International Committee of the Red Cross to their home countries. Imprisoned Allied officers were paid the same salary as officers of the Japanese Army. Prisoners taken during operations in battle zones where no POW camps or prisoner administration existed were considered irregulars and were the responsibility of local Japanese field commanders, nearly all of whom believed that the fate of prisoners should be decided by strategic and economic convenience. Well, this turned out to mean that the Japanese Army and Navy could keep prisoners under conditions comparable to those that had decimated Americans confined in Confederate and Union prisons during the U.S. Civil War, or that at the start of the 20th century had led to the deaths of tens of thousands of Boers in the British built and operated concentration camps in South Africa. The Allied POWs and internees of World War II suffered from malnutrition, chronic disease, and overwork at the hands of Japanese military personnel and civilian guards. And in the process, they were often beaten or threatened, put into solitary confinement, deprived of sleep. Sometimes Japanese soldiers blindfolded captives, shaved their heads, restricted their meals, forced them into uncomfortable stress positions to make them talk. Water torture and electric shock awaited those who refused. Japanese violated international law as well by failing to register some prisoners or facilities with the International Red Cross. And where Allied flyers were concerned, the common feeling of many Japanese was that, quote, they had no right to treaty protections because they'd committed such war crimes as indiscriminate bombing of cities. Well, the American judges and prosecutors at the Yokohama trials had a different, higher standard of justice. They regarded these actions as punishable offenses, but they also punished Japanese guards and interrogators for any unpleasant or disadvantageous treatment of any kind. Their goal was to establish the principle of ultimate accountability and set a benchmark for the punishment of future war criminals. By inflicting sanctions for even comparatively small offenses, they hoped to establish a precedent barring any prisoner mistreatment. Now, if I had the time, I would have said, okay, let's consider next some of the methods employed in America's global war on terror that violate international law, because these include that classification, the dual classification of prisoners, labeling some as terrorists and others and what is it, non-combatant prisoners? Is that that other category? In addition, bombing civilians in rural villages and urban areas, then writing off their death and maiming as unintentional collateral damage. Torturing detainees in places like Abu Ghraib, Bagram Air Base, and Guantanamo. Today, you know, it's U.S. forces, CIA interrogators, and civilian mercenaries who perpetrate these tortures, abuses, and outrages against human dignity. And their victims are enemy captives, mostly civilians, whom they arrest and subject to open-ended detention and interrogation. And also remember that new American torture techniques come to light all the time. Bush has replicated the Imperial Army's regular, irregular classification of prisoners, declaring most detainees in the American gulag around the world as enemy combatants unprotected by Geneva Conventions and thus subject to different treatment. Admittedly, the Japanese Army prohibited surrender on the battlefield, and most Japanese officers regarded international law with contempt. But I think that I've never found any Japanese evidence of a Japanese government official openly repudiating the Geneva Prisoner of War Convention. Nor did Japanese intellectuals ever write in Japan's mass-circulated newspapers and leading magazines discussing, let alone advocating, torture the way the liberal ideologists of torture, Michael Ignatieff and Harvard's Alan Dershowitz have. So if you bear these points in mind, examine the hands-on physical tortures and what historian Alfred McCall calls the no-touch mental tortures that have come to light in recent years. If there are differences between what some Japanese did to POWs in World War II and what the U.S. and its agents practice today under executive branch authorization, examining these lists will help to bring them to light. The conclusion I draw, I do this and then I ask questions. And the questions I ask are, where do the differences lie between behavior prosecuted 60 years ago as Japanese war crimes and the crimes and cruelties that U.S. military officials and CIA personnel committed regularly during the Cold War and that they are again committing in Iraq, Afghanistan, and globally? And the next question I ask is, how does the American torture and abuse of prisoners compare with Japan's treatment of prisoners? And the short answer is that the war crimes committed by U.S. forces in places where the U.S. is implementing its GWAT, you know what the GWAT is, the Global War on Terrorism, are no different from the criminal and unethical behavior for which Allied crimes courts once punished the Japanese. Formerly, we executed them for committing crimes against male and female detainees that today senior U.S. military and civil officials not only know about but routinely order in violation of their legal obligation not to commit aggression or war crimes. The last part of my paper was about new perspectives that have developed on the issues I'm talking about, new scholarly perspectives. I'll skip over these new scholarly perspectives and conclude by saying that, and by the way, when you look at what the new scholarship has to teach us on some of these issues, then you see that one of the reasons why more Allied prisoners died in Japanese captivity than Western European Allied prisoners died in German captivity was because nearly one-third of the deaths of those Allied POWs were inflicted by friendly fire. They were friendly fire deaths. A staggering 19,000 POW deaths at sea were caused by friendly fire. According to one recent study, this was a third of the total number of American casualties during the Vietnam War. And that explodes the myth of unique Japanese cruelty as well. Now, why did it happen? Why this huge number of friendly fire deaths? Well, the combined chiefs of staff were concerned only with winning, not with the plight of POWs or the sacrifices they made. The official Navy policy was candidly expressed in a letter that the Secretary of the Navy at the time, James V. Forrestal, wrote to Mrs. Lucy Ferguson, who'd lost her husband, a Navy doctor, aboard the Arisan Maru when a U.S. submarine torpedoed it in October of 44 with the loss of 1,800 American POWs. You know, first the Navy tried to fob her off by saying that the Japanese freighter on which her husband died bore no mark to indicate it was carrying POWs, but in fact, in Hawaii and in Australia, the commands there knew fairly accurately exactly how many Allied prisoners were put aboard each ship that departed from a Philippine port or a Dutch East Indies port or from Singapore. And then Forrestal revealed the truth in his letter to Mrs. Ferguson. And he said, even though our intelligence began to establish the fact that the Japanese were transporting Americans in their ships, the great necessity of destroying Japan's vital lifeline of shipping gave us no choice but to sink all Japanese ships encountered. In other words, strategic advantage was deemed more important than the prospect of Allied POWs. I want to thank you for listening so patiently. You had no choice, of course. But I think what my discussion showed was first that the trials that followed in the wake of World War II gave U.S. and Allied leaders a global stage in which to act out standards, their standards. In some cases, they were double standards, and to weave them into the legal charters of the War Crimes Tribunal. Yet the legal precedents set by Nuremberg and Tokyo, as well as the U.S. Military Commission trials, despite their many limitations, still continue to serve as a useful measure of how far the United States has regressed from its earlier short-lived commitment to a universal international law applicable to all sovereign states. These trials intended to set precedents for the future for all nations did much good. Yet even as they ran their course, the U.S. and Britain were hedging their bets. In view of the many wars and military incursions that the United States has fought uninterruptedly since 45, not to mention the global nuclear arms race and militarism that the U.S. has fostered, the world would have been better served from closer scrutiny of how the U.S. waged all-out war in Asia and the Pacific. And it would have been better still if, before the Cold War had again divided the world, some way had been found to adjudicate American violations of the laws of war. Thank you.